Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And if we continue in our appeals to heaven, we need to continually learn, and we need to kind of start understanding. And hopefully, folks, as we go through the Constitution, it's going to give you this better understanding of what, it's not just what we should have, it's what our potential could really be if we were in compliance to the Constitution. In other words, just look at it this way, and welcome back, Sean. Thank you for hanging in there with me.
And good to be here, sir.
So, for years and years, the federal government has actually played games in economic warfare and so forth. And as a matter of fact, those games started kicking in more and more as America started becoming more prominent in the international sphere. And so America really had its problems, and it was very focused internally upon those problems. And the one, so in the very beginning of the Republic, the harassment of Britain and the imminent threat that Britain basically possessed, I mean, you couldn't just not think that Britain at any point in time could attack us, right? So, because they were capturing our ships, they were basically stealing our commerce, and they were impressing our sailors, charging them and making them, enslaving them on Navy, British Navy ships and so forth. So, there was this, I'll just say, America really couldn't start developing itself because of its entanglement with Britain. It was not finished. Now, during the War of 1812, we kind of finished that, but we know for a fact that Britain really wasn't done. As a matter of fact, Britain basically continued infiltrating us, and Britain was constantly trying to assist in our demise, in throwing things in, trying to get us corrupt, or corrupting us so that we would actually start infighting and basically dividing and conquering. Does that make sense? Sean, are you there, or did I lose you?
No, I'm here.
So. Oh, okay.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Oh, okay.
They're still at it today, it appears.
Yeah, they are. But the big thing that they got away with in dividing and conquering was the issue over slavery. That was a white hot, and I don't mean it in a racial term, I mean it in a temperature term. That was the white hot issue that, you know, basically we were slaves to the slavery issue. We just couldn't break free of it as long as slavery existed. So Britain was instantly trying to instigate aggressions on the northern side and basically trying to instigate secession and or rebellion on the southern side. Now, the states, if the Constitution is being violated, any state, like right now, because of the severity of the unconstitutional government that is doing all sorts of different warfare tactics against us, because that's what kind of started this little diatribe. But if we look at going into the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, the northern states started playing with commerce in ways that would have an adverse effect on the southern states. In other words, the goods that they needed were different than the goods that were needed up north. And so they made sure that there were greater taxes on those so that it would be punishing them so that the north could be making money. You got to remember that the South actually was the first ones to go into the realm of dirty deeds because of the Missouri Compromise and inflicting slavery upon states joining the Union. that right there, you know, basically got all of the abolished, you know, the abolitionists flat-footed. They didn't realize that they, you know, they would be able to do this. I mean, nobody could fathom this. And unfortunately, not one state stood up and said, you can't do that. I'm just amazed that the states continually rolled over, and it may have been more of an informational thing. And I say that because the flow of information coming out of D.C. into the states wasn't like it is today. I mean, there is a lot of information that's tailored towards a narrative because that's what the progressives do. But you know, because we do have a lot of different, I'll just say, outlets of journalism and so forth, that we get a better flow out of all that information. Back in those days, it was a lot easier to suppress than it is today. So they were very capable of creating narratives out of D.C., which is one of the reasons why I think they got away with the Missouri Compromise. And the states, you know, once it was done, oh, what are we going to do? And I think at that point, they may have already come to the conclusion that whenever the federal government does something and you go to court, that the court is going to side with the government. Because it seemed like that was what John Marshall was doing. And he was actually puffing up and building up the federal powers in his opinions and everything else, because he had like 8 major landmark cases that literally aggrandized the federal government through those, I call them the portal clauses. In other words, the portal clauses in the Constitution was the Necessary and Proper Clause, the General Defense and Welfare Clause, the Supremacy Clause, and the Commerce Clause. Those clauses, you know, they were able to redefine and say, oh, we can do anything necessary and proper. If we deem it necessary and proper, we can do it. That's what Marshall was alluding to in his opinions. And the Supremacy Clause, oh, well, we're supreme in all things, and so he would marry these things in with the necessary problem. Because we thought it necessary and we're supreme, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. He was literally, this was the beginning of redefining things. And so it wasn't until the 1830s when Madison was basically getting, you know, he was in his real autumn years before he passed away. I think he passed away in 1836, 37, somewhere in there. And so those last couple of years, 1835, maybe 1834, his ability to get engaged was even less. And again, there wasn't a lot of information. And most of his friends, because he was the young guy, so most of his friends weren't alive anymore. I think Monroe was still alive at that point in time. So he was conversing with him, but he probably didn't have lots of channels of conversation. And even though he lived in Virginia, I wouldn't say it's a stone throws away. Marlbury was kind of a reasonable distance from D.C. So he probably had some basic information coming in. But here's the thing, and this is, I get asked this question more often than not. Why did James Madison not refute the federal government's opinions when Marshall was making these opinions, saying that they were greater, you know, the supremacy meant that they can do anything they want? Because at that point in time, opinions were like, you know, other orifices, right? And so everybody had them. Marshall was just basically spouting off his, and he had a little platform called the Supreme Court to where he could get away with spewing his opinions. Opinions have no weight. If you look at the Constitution, it means that, you know, they're just adding an opinion to a ruling. The only thing that had weight was the ruling. And Madison looked at the rulings and said, was he correct in the rulings? And every time he was correct. It's the opinions that he used, or it's the opinions that he created that they used later. This is where the Federalist Papers come in, because at this point in time, Marshall had already started pushing out the Federalist Papers, and it probably had it highlighted for the judiciary's copies. Please note, in 78 and 79, you know, these very specific Federalist Papers, you know, the highlighted the parts where the federal judiciary would be able to assume greater power. And so once they got close, and I think it was like 1835, 1836, when Congress allowed the Supreme Court to regulate themselves. In other words, they extended the honor amongst thieves to the Supreme Court. Now, you got to remember, because we covered it this year, but you weren't a part of it, but I think you were a part of the discussions in other meetings, where we disclosed that the Congress was getting away with playing a Ponzi scheme and developing the District of Columbia at the expense of the states, as well as taking away and whittling down state sovereignty by taking their land and selling it. So Congress was already getting away with stuff, and it seemed like maybe the court was covering for them, because that's, I think, what the prevailing trend is. I remember listening to Thomas Sowell in one of his books talking about why the Supreme Court is, you know, has this propensity of ruling in favor, wrongly ruling in favor of federal court or the federal government's actions, because they're playing defense. You know, they're all on the same team. This goes back to, and this is why those five critical documents, the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, then the second Kentucky resolutions, Madison's report on the Virginia resolutions, and Madison's notes on nullification, those five documents really clarify, you know, the details of the Constitution, who should be engaging, who has the responsibility of keeping the federal government in check. Because at this point in time, as Madison was dying, everybody believed that the Supreme Court, you know, they were the final arbiters of everything. And we've learned otherwise, because we covered that in those documents as well this year, and I cover it every year when we go through them, and we're going to do it again this year. So all of this being said, we could see how the court finally, the genie got out of the bottle in the 1830s when they could start regulating themselves, and this is when the court injected case law and precedents. In other words, instead of ruling on each case independently based on law and fact, they said, well, this is very similar to this because of this and this. And this is where the prowess, the artistic license of the jurists were able to create these intricate, I'll just call them mazes of legal arguments, where they were able to create what would be a seamless argument that got them to allow what was happening, and this is how they justified stuff, by using case law precedents, as well as interpreting the law and redefining the law and making law. I mean, the Supreme Court, by the 1830s, got out of the bottle, and it was just, there was nothing holding it back anymore. That's how bad it got. So as we go through this, hopefully you're starting to see, folks, and if we actually get the federal government into its full containment, back into the real framework and the scope of the Constitution, I'm hoping that you're seeing, as we discuss certain things that the states could really do, we would need some real tangible, at least one or two tangible amendments. And the states could really work together and establish very strong strategies that would not be selling us downriver to foreign nations. Why? Because we have no ability to be dealing with foreign nations. Now, one of the things we kind of covered, Sean, is in Article 2, it's clear that the president has the responsibility. When we read through Article 1 regarding Congress, there is nothing there that talks about Congress making deals and dealing with foreign nations. Not at all. They have this little power of regulating foreign trade. In other words, it's their job to create the laws. But those laws need to go in tandem with the president's, I'll just say, his agenda in dealing with foreign nations. That right there became kind of problematic, because if you had a really bad president like Nixon, he basically gave a very evil, nefarious nation, China, most favored nation status. And when, in so doing, we were able to basically start funneling money into China in the 1970s. And thanks to good old America, we have created a very formidable enemy, because they couldn't do it on their own. Folks, there was no one in the world that could come and even come close to what we were capable of doing. So we had to give away our secrets. We had to give away our money and help them. All these nations, Russia got help by us, China's gotten help by us, and through them, through those both of those nations, via proxy, they've been assisting North Korea, Cuba, and the rest of these nations. So we have been instrumental in developing global communism and creating this webbing that we're going to be thrown into. This is not, you know, the globalists just doing this. We had to be a part of it. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. Okay. Eternal vigilance.
Yeah. So, okay. So as we look at the Article 2 and the president's responsibility to be dealing with the foreign nations, and having these emissaries and so forth. In 1790, there was a man called Logan, and I think he was maybe a congressperson from Pennsylvania that actually went to France and started brokering a deal that would benefit Pennsylvania. And I don't know the full details, but I do know that because of that, and I think John Adams was the president at the time, John Adams basically got Congress to give him the Logan Act. And the Logan Act made it a crime for any person, whether they be Congress or state legislature, any person that goes and deals with a foreign entity and deals directly with them would be in violation of the powers, because the power was given to the president, the executive, to be in those positions and in those spaces in brokering deals. And so, therefore, when we look at the Logan Act, then you can actually see what Bill Gates has been doing for years, and other prominent businessmen, the Rockefellers and so forth, they've been violating the Logan Act. So the other thing that we, you know, kind of talk about, and we talked about all of the Senate's roles and responsibilities by now, and I want to kind of go through this before we move on into Article 2, Section 3. The Senate clearly has a large swath of roles and responsibilities. And as a matter of fact, I've written a document. Actually, it's an article, and it's actually on the Constitutional Articles page. And if you go to the Constitutional Articles page, folks, you'll actually find an article that says the truth about the 17th Amendment. Now, I know, Sean, you kind of read that. And so in the truth on the 17th Amendment, I actually dive into every line in the Constitution, every clause that deals with the Senate. And, folks, if you pull this in, this is where it gets color-coded on page 3, and it's only 6 pages. And so on page 3, this is where I get into the language of the roles and responsibilities regarding the Senate and the senators in Article 1. And I have a full listing of everything that they, you know, have noted on here. Now, if you look, I believe it says that, you know, how the state will handle the vacancies is one of those, as well as how they are chosen. Out of the 9 different issues that is addressed, you know, by specific roles, responsibilities, standards, and so forth, out of all of them, that only dealt with 2 of the issues. In other words, the Senate has a lot more mentions, or I should say the Constitution delineates for senators and the U.S. Senate to do very specific things. And so as we look at what that Senate responsibilities, roles, and everything else does right here in this document, you'll notice that they actually have a lot on their plate, very specific to the Senate and working with the president. And then the next part, just below that, is the language of the roles and responsibilities regarding the Senate and senators in Article 2. So, folks, what I've done is I've given you all the things that the senators are responsible for. And if you go through the language of the 17th Amendment, the 17th Amendment only touched two out of all of these things that they had. And the two things that it touched was how they were to be chosen and how they were to be replaced. It didn't change their responsibilities of working with the president and appointing and accepting the appointments of judges and so forth and so on, with their advice and consent. So all of these things that were in the Constitution for their roles and responsibilities, nothing changed. And as a matter of fact, their responsibility of who they were representing didn't change either. The only thing that changed was how they were to be chosen and how they were to be replaced. That is it. Therefore, their responsibility still went to the states. The state legislature is very specific. So when you go, when we went through the Constitution Convention, and we could clearly see that the state legislature was getting its suffrage out of the U.S. Senate, and we, the people, got our suffrage out of the House of Representatives. So they had two separate representative bodies. This is where I go into this concept of American republicanism. Basic republicanism is a representative government, and it is typically, in all cases other than in America, it is the representation of the people. We expanded this concept of representation by having and affording representation to sovereigns, not just we the people. And what does that mean? It means that when we create a government, that government has sovereignty over very specific things, such as our county government. They have responsibilities of dealing with the businesses and the commerce throughout the state and so forth. So they have that state legislative body, or I should say the county legislative body, has some real specific roles that they need to attend to that is being dealt with in the state legislature, which is why the state legislatures, all of them, and I pointed this out so many times, folks, that at the time the Constitution was ratified, every state had different configurations. It's not, you know, a coincidence that every state reconfigured itself like the U.S. Constitution, creating bicameral legislative bodies, where the Senate represented the counties and the House represented the people of the counties. And as a matter of fact, I will offer you Washington State Constitution. And if you go through the Washington State Constitution, you will notice that every county is guaranteed a minimum of one representative, just like the U.S. Constitution. So in other words, many of the states actually started copying this framework that is in the U.S. Constitution, and it all got swiped away, or I should say it got backhanded by the Supreme Court in changing the representation in the Senate. In other words, they basically tried to move us away from, and the 17th Amendment tried to move us away from state suffrage in the Senate, but it didn't. Does that make sense, Sean?
Yes, sir.
So it didn't, because the language wasn't there. It was implied. And Sean, do you know why the language didn't touch the representation of the state legislature? That suffrage for them? You know why it didn't have that?
Because they didn't change that.
Well, I know that they didn't change it, but why didn't they actually add that language in the 17th Amendment to say that the senators will then represent the people of the state? And take away
because
the state.
It didn't change.
Well, actually, no. In Article 5, there is an amendment protection clause that says no amendment shall be made that will deny the state legislature. So we'll be back, because we're going into break here real quick. So we will be back in just a little over a minute. But folks, this is why I want to dive into this, because there is something going on, and every time the Senate is making, you know, judgments and or votes and so forth, they're pulling the wool over our eyes. We can fix this, but let me get back to this when we come back from break. We'll be right back, folks.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so in Article 5, there is this language at the very end that are referred to amendment protection clauses. In other words, the Constitution literally has restrictions on amendments. There's two types of amendments could not be passed. One amendment could not be passed prior to 1808, which would be the ability of the federal government to regulate the importation of slaves to shut down the slave trade. That amendment protection made sure that the South couldn't use their money to buy an amendment to allow them to to cut that out of Article 1, Section 9, because that's where it's at, where in 1808, the federal government will then be able to actually regulate the importation of persons. That's it, instead of the states. Importation. In other words, they're going out and bringing in very specific people, not the immigration of persons or the migration of people, the importation. See, the federal government had no role or responsibility over immigration and or importation and so forth. So they created an amendment protection to ensure that no state could make an amendment that would shut that shutting down of the slave trade in the Constitution. They wouldn't be able to remove that, stop that, because they wanted to make sure that they could start getting rid of the slave trade, which would ultimately get rid of slavery. There was another amendment protection clause in Article 5, and in Article 5, it basically says, and if you just add the very beginning, provided that no amendment which shall be made without and that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. The language may say state, but it was very well understood that the state meant the state legislature, the sovereigns of the state, that they had suffrage in the Senate. And this is broken down in both ratification debates. When they talk about the state suffrage, they're talking about the state legislature very specifically. So as we look at this, the 17th Amendment couldn't have that language. Does that make sense now?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so had it had that language, then the 17th Amendment could have actually been shot down to say, hey, you're doing something in this amendment that in Article 5 it doesn't allow you to do. So they were at least cognizant that they only had the ability to change a perception. So what that means, folks, is that the amendment, the 17th Amendment, was used as a, what's a good word for it? It was used as a facade. It was used as a perception changer that, oh, now that the people select their senators, then the people are represented in the Senate. Well, that language wasn't included in the 17th Amendment. It only changed the selection and replacement. It would have actually had to change as well Article 5, because Article 5 was the amendment protection to ensure that the state legislature would never lose its suffrage without its consent. And because you can't change that, they were in between a rock and a hard place. Does that make sense? There was just nowhere they could actually do what they needed to do. So they just created this facade to convince people that the state legislature no longer has suffrage. You with me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So when we look at the shutting down of the federal government because of the Senate demanding that we use money to pay for health care for illegals and a bunch of other crap, right? And they wanted that included in this bill that they wanted to get passed. Now, when we look at, because folks, I covered this, but I want to cover this again. If you understand what this article is telling you, then I ask you to go look at the composition of the U.S. Senate today. And so I've got it here, and Sean can see this. And when you look at all of the different states, you'll find that there are, let me just count them, because it's going to be two for each, right? So we just add up the numbers and divide by two. So this is, and I'm not adding up the split states. In other words, there are states out there that actually have a split control of the state legislature. In other words, there are some state legislatures that have a Republican House and a Democrat Senate, or vice versa. Those are split states. But when we look at how many states out there have full Republican control, the total is 30. 30 states, folks. That means 60 votes for the Senate. But here's the problem. Sean, do all of these red states with Republican control have Republican senators in the U.S. Senate?
No, they do not.
No, they do not. And so, folks, you need to get this into your brain housing group. When you look at, because actually when you look at these split states, every split state has Democratic senators. Every Democratic-controlled legislature has Democratic senators. But we have Republican-controlled states that don't have Republican senators. They have Democratic senators. So let's pull up the first one, which is Arizona. Arizona, which is a hard, very, very Republican-controlled legislature, they have two Democratic senators. Now, let me go back to the suffrage. These state legislatures, specifically in Arizona, can tell Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego, or however you pronounce that last name.
Gallego.
They have the authority to tell them how to vote. You will vote for shutting down, or not shutting down the government. You will vote against that bill that demands that money to go to illegal aliens. You will vote this way, and you won't shut down the government. That makes sense, right? So that's two votes right there that move back to, because when we add this up, we're going to add up how many votes were taken away from these red state legislatures. So that's two. Now we have Georgia, and both of the senators for the state of Georgia are Democrat. So that's two more. And there, the Democrats hold the line. And then we go down a little bit further, and we'll find some of the split states, which we're not going to count those. We're only counting the red, because that's all I counted in the first place. So we come down to New Hampshire. New Hampshire is another state that has two Democratic senators. That's six. Remember, we got 60, hardcore 60. Remember, I told you that when you really look at the split states, the Democrats do not have control over 20 states. There are several states that are split. In other words, they're down in the teens. How is it that they have this control in the Senate? Because they buy these seats. How did the two Democrats get into Georgia? California sent millions of dollars into those elections to get them in. Now, let's put aside the election altogether. Let's look at the language of the Constitution. The state legislature is guaranteed its equal suffrage in the Senate, which means that they have the right to declare what those votes are going to be in the Senate. Those senators are proxies. They're there to vote for the state legislature so that the state legislature doesn't have to be in D.C. They can't be in two places at once, so we created a representative body in Congress to represent the state legislature and represent us, we the people. We have the ability to hold them accountable. The state legislatures can actually say, if you do not vote the way we just guided you to vote, then you've just denied us our equal suffrage in the Senate, which we actually have in the Constitution protected. What I mean by that is when you look at Article 5, it says they cannot lose their equal suffrage in the Senate without their consent. And if they're not given consent and they're demanding that those senators vote a certain way, then those senators have to give them their votes. Pretty simple, right? At least it's simple to me.
I do have a question about that, though.
Yeah, go ahead.
If you don't mind.
Go ahead.
When you say equal suffrage, is that not talking about each state will have two senators?
Well, so, yes, they wanted to make sure that there would always be an even number. And they wanted to make sure that between one election and the next, the Senate, so this is why they created three classes. I don't know if we talked about that in Article
1. I get that part, but what I'm talking about is the suffrage for the state. I get what you're saying, and I agree that the legislature gets suffrage in the government through the Senate.
Right.
But the thing about the equal suffrage hasn't changed. They still have two for each state.
Yes, they have two for each state as well, but that suffrage is for the state legislature. So they're to be equal, and the state legislature has that suffrage. In other words, the state legislature not only has suffrage, they have equal suffrage.
Got it.
Okay.
I got you.
Okay. So now let's go down a little further because we've already identified six turncoats, or I should say three states that have actually been duped by nefarious money coming in from outside of the state and buying these senators. And this is why Senate races, folks, are getting into the billions. Down in Pennsylvania has one senator that's Democrat, and that's John Fetterman. And John Fetterman, he sure comes out to be like this really super good conservative guy, right? Right? I mean, you see my point. He has to be that way, just like Manchin had to be that way when it came to West Virginia. If Manchin wasn't touting the line to seem conservative enough, he would lose his piece or his seat because these are pretty conservative states. Now, we also go down a little bit further, and we'll find Wisconsin also has one Democratic senator. So there are three states that are split. Or is it three states? There's one, two. No, there's two states that are split, and then the rest. So that comes up to 52 Republican senators in the U.S. Senate. In other words, they have the votes, but the problem is in some of these states, and I've got it highlighted here, in Alaska, Lisa Murkowski, who's supposedly a Republican, constantly votes and supports the Democratic side. And in this particular vote, she did that. And you actually have in Maine another one. Where's the Maine? Right there. And Maine happens to be a split state, and it's Susan Collins and Angus King. And so they probably gave those two senators, probably if you look at how they voted, which ones flipped? Because the Republicans actually had the majority. How did the government get shut down, and how is it that we're being held hostage in, you know, demanding money for illegals, for invaders, health care? And folks, I'm telling you that if you really look in accordance to the Constitution, the facts are overwhelming. If you actually start going down the path, because right now it is, when I look at the numbers, it's 52 to 48. Hard numbers, when you're just looking at the title of each senator, there's 52 Republicans to 48. So let's go and let's play suffrage of the state legislature. And if we actually have split states, then let's just count them that way, because I would throw the split states could easily become one or two votes easily going into favor of the Republicans. How would that be? Well, so let's just say that a state wants to have suffrage, and at a few points in time, they have a real split where the House really wants the senator, the senators to vote a certain way, and the Senate splits. Then I believe it would be best that the state actually allows one House, the House of Representatives, to direct one of the senators to vote one way and the other senator to vote the other way. What that does, folks, is that creates an automatic cancellation. So it may actually bump the numbers up equally, but it's just like a cancellation. It's like that state didn't help move the line anyway. And it's better to have states actually, you know, out of contention than it is to, you know, allow them to vote down these nefarious lines to getting paid and so forth and moving the global agenda. This is why when you look at the split states, such as Michigan, Minnesota, and Maine, well, Maine is actually Republican. Actually, it is split now, but I mean, Maine was, and they were basically Democrats when you look at it. The only reason that they're yellow is because they're technically split now. Do we have any other splits? I think there was another. Nope, that's just those three. So those three states actually have splits. So if I added up those three, which would give me six more, it would give us 66 Republican votes, or I should say 66 Republican state house votes in the Senate versus what? What would be remaining? 34. That's two-thirds to right? That's what the numbers are. Two-thirds to one-third. It is that overwhelming. What do you think, Sean?
I think that's what's gotten us into trouble, for sure.
And it's not the 17th Amendment that did it. Everybody out there, the John Birchers, everybody is besmirching the 17th Amendment. The 17th Amendment didn't do anything other than change the appointment and the replacement. We had to be vigilant in understanding the rest of the Constitution that those senators still had to represent the state legislature. And yet today, if you go to any state legislature, you go to your state legislature, folks, and you ask them, are the U.S. senators giving you your suffrage in this U.S. Senate? Oh, heck no. We call them and talk to them, and it's just this, you know, million-mile stare that they give us. Well, who are you? That's how bad it is. So when you're looking at the politics in D.C., you're looking at this fact that the government was shut down. See, the Democrats are okay with problems being created. The ends justify the means. They don't care. They hope that it hurts us. It hurts us because that's what they want to do. They want to destroy us, not just hurt us. They want to destroy us. So they don't care about the damages and the mayhem that's caused. They don't care about the wasting of money and handing it over to people who constitutionally shouldn't even be here. Constitutionally shouldn't even be getting benefits and being a drain on us. There's no nation in the world that allows this crap. We have literally an outright insurrection going on politically, and just because they have a different view, they believe they're protected. This is why we emphasize Section 3. It doesn't matter what your political affiliation is. If that political affiliation has you doing things that are contrary to the U.S. Constitution, then you are in insurrection with the Constitution, and you are no longer allowed. You're at that point, you're ineligible to be in office. So in other words, all these Democrats, folks, every single Democrat that's touting the Democratic line in giving away money to illegals, allowing invaders to stay in America, whether they be judges, whether they be senators, representatives, executives through the states, it doesn't matter. This maze of communists throughout our government are literally getting away with violating the Constitution and maintaining these seats. This is why you hear me say this all the time. Trump has the power. Trump has the authority to start enforcing the law. And I'll tell you what, if these red legislative states demanded their suffrage in the Senate, if Trump actually hears today's show and he goes, you know what, we're actually going to go and we're going to enable these state legislatures and make sure that they're getting their suffrage. And any senator that fails to vote the way that state legislature directed them, and that state legislature comes to us and says, hey, we've been denied our suffrage, then he will pull them from the floor, send them back, and let the state replace them. And they will be replaced by Republicans, folks, because millions of dollars won't be going into anybody's pockets. We will actually see tangible changes in America when we actually start holding people accountable to their oath. Section 3, as many people besmirch the 14th Amendment, Section 3 is the godsend. It is the final dot that empowers us to take our government back. You have no accountability. You have no control over your government. But Section 3 of the 14th Amendment gives us full accountability. It's that important, and it's that simple. So any further comments, anything else you want to?
Well, I'm interested in what you were talking about with President Trump enforcing this.
Yes.
How would you see that going down?
Well, so clearly, and so this is a part of the show. That's a great question. When we read Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, is there any process that allows a vote or due process where a court is going to convene? It is really cut and dry. When the state legislature says that we told our senator to vote this way and they voted, look at their vote. They voted differently. You look at our communication. We clearly communicated that they vote that way. We've been denied. It's a cut and dry case. I mean, you don't need court because you have the evidence and the evidence is clear. They violated their oath to support the Constitution, ergo, to give their state legislature their suffrage. That's why they're there. And the Constitution mandates that they must do that. And because they didn't, then they're caught red-handed in not giving them their suffrage. Guess what's going to happen with all these Democratic senators that are sitting in the Senate after the first two or maybe six of them get replaced? Because it was clear in these six cases, boom, six are gone. What's going to happen the next time a Democrat comes in and we have a Republican state legislature? They're going to do everything that state legislature tells them to do. So in other words, we've removed literally the composition of the party within the Senate, and it sends it back to the state houses. And if you look at the numbers, folks, the flyover states will never be marginalized ever again because they're the ones that's saving our butts. Because they're the ones that are bastions of conservatism and support of the Constitution. And it goes down to every state has equal suffrage. In other words, one state has one voice. When you go into a constitutional convention, do you just count all the delegates by a popular vote? No. Each state votes. And that's why when we went through the ratification debates, every time it was voted upon, each state had yay or nay. They had to vote amongst themselves, and the carrying vote went yay, or the carrying vote went nay. And so when they were asked, how does Virginia vote? Yay. There wasn't seven or however many delegates of representing Virginia at the Constitutional Convention. It's the same thing with the state Constitutional Conventions. Every county has one vote. This concept of democracy is what's destroying us. Equal representation. Why? Because every county, every state has their own relevant sovereignty. It doesn't matter how many people you have a right to protect your interests, and your interests are equal to everybody else's. You may not have the equal amount of people there, but you still have equal interests. This is why this framework of this form of republicanism, of recognizing sovereignty, is what's been saving our butt for 200 years. And it's been under attack and under attack and under attack in the Supreme Court with the Baker v. Carr, then Reynolds v. Sims, those two cases in that order, is how the Supreme Court used two cases to backhand the states and steal the county suffrage in the state legislature, as well as pervert the county suffrage in the House. Because now the House has to split. when you look at many states now, if you've got red counties that are very sparsely populated, they don't have equal voice anymore. They still have equal interest. One county's interest is equal to another county's interest. It doesn't matter how you want to slice it. You can't put because, oh, we're closer to the water. We make more money. We have more people. Doesn't matter. Every county has an equal vote, and they need to have that equal representation in the Senate. Now, voting for the people and the people's interest, whether we're going to war or these types of things, that would be different. But even in the state of Washington, as a matter of fact, I before we move back into the Constitution, folks, I think it's imperative that I open up the Washington State Constitution. This way, in so doing, I'm going to show Sean. And so this way, I have a witness because I don't want to just say things. You know what I mean, Sean? I want people to know that those literally are the words. And if you go to the Washington State Constitution, folks, you'll be able to read this. And when we go into where is apportionment, you got to look up apportionment. And so where is the apportionment? It's in the 20s, so that'll be double X. And legislative apportionment, see it right there? It's 22. See, it's all highlighted, too. And this is what it says for the Senate. This section one is for the Senate apportionment. And it says, until otherwise provided by law, so in other words, until the Constitution has been changed, the state shall be divided into 24 senatorial districts. And the said and the districts are based on county districts. And the said districts shall be constituted and numbered as follows. The counties of Stevens and Spokane shall constitute the first district and be entitled to one senator. The county of Spokane shall constitute the second district and be entitled to three senators. The county of Lincoln shall constitute the third district and be entitled to one senator. And you're going to go through here where they have a couple of counties that actually share their senator, but most every county has this basic representation. And so Okanagan, Lincoln, Adams, and Franklin shall constitute the fourth and be entitled to one. So these are really small counties, and they're mountainous or what have you. So even though they didn't necessarily give them equal suffrage, they identified what the boundaries were the counties. And so when you go through here, you'll notice that there's no changement. And actually it says at the very bottom, it says the county of Whatcom shall constitute the 24th district and be entitled to one senator. Districts and apportionments, chapter 44 in the RCW. Now this right here, maybe where they included, and if I go to that, I'll probably find where the Supreme Court ruled that this was unconstitutional, they needed to change that. Well, folks, the Supreme Court does not have the authority in the Washington State Constitution or in the U.S. Constitution to direct states how they are to be formed politically, how they are to be formed in the architecture of their government. As a matter of fact, it was very clear that the federal government could not meddle with the form of the state, how they wanted to do politics and everything else. The Supreme Court had no authority to actually change, reach in and change the framework of the states. And that's exactly what they did. And this happened in the 1960s with the Progressive Warren Court. And this is how we got invoked. When we come back in our next episode, I'll wrap this up because I'm going to go into how the counties equally have representation in the House. Folks, I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.